I actually said to my husband, I've never been so happy to leave America and put politics behind me for a week. And of course, every person I meet today wants to talk about politics. So maybe it's just where we are. Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you very much for the invitation. I think this is fabulous to have a series like this. We need to have series like this even in the U.S. The experience of the First World War is not well known in the United States, and I think in many respects the experience of America is not well known in World War I scholarship outside the United States. So I'm really happy to have a chance to come and talk to you today. And what I wanted to talk about was the impact of the war on American social justice movements, and I titled my talk "Deeds, Not Words." And so this is what I'm going to focus on today. Now, we know that every war has winners and losers on the battlefield, on the negotiation table, and on the home front. And today I want to think a little bit about social justice movements in the United States, which most often are characterized as big losers as a result of the war. For the civil rights movement, the female suffrage movement, and the civil liberties movement, nobody disputes that the war was a pivotal moment. And the traditional American narrative offers a fairly stark assessment of the dire impact of the war on pretty much all but the female suffrage movement. And even that movement isn't necessarily given high marks. African Americans, we are told, followed W.E.B. Du Bois's advice to close ranks with white Americans in the hopes that evidence of their patriotism would strengthen their case for full equality. The Red Summer of 1919, which follows the war, which is so named because of an historically high number of lynchings and race riots, this seemingly revealed the delusion of that promise. The peace movement failed to prevent American entry into the war and found itself, once America was at war, attacked and vilified. Men seeking conscientious objector status found this a daunting and dangerous task, and pacifism almost became akin to socialism, vaguely foreign and definitely un-American. And the lone bright spot seemed to be the surprise success of the female suffrage movement with the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which in 1920 granted women the right to vote. But even this victory was followed by a sense that without this unifying cause, the feminist movement sort of fell apart. Now, there's much more to this story, and that's what I want to talk about today, because it's my contention that wartime created a cultural environment in which activists certainly found new restraints, and that's a little bit of what I've just recounted now. But I think that they also found new possibilities for advancing their causes. And to adequately understand the history of movement building in the United States, we need to consider how the war unintentionally provided opportunities for movement building, new venues for recruiting leadership, new strategies, which I think is really important, and new ways to recruit members into these social justice campaigns. So when Woodrow Wilson leads the United States into war in April 1917, there is no doubt that he leads a divided nation into war. And because the nation is divided and there had been so much argument about whether or not this was America's war to fight, we see a tremendous effort being exerted from above and from below to enforce cooperation and certainly to silence dissent. And it's easy to look at the range of federal government activities in this realm. We see a vast propaganda campaign, the enforcement of anti-sedition legislation that at first only prohibited interfering with the draft, and then by 1918 outlawed criticism of the war effort and the government. And for many citizens, this coercive pressure came not just from the top, not just from the government, but it came from their communities as well. Within communities, friends and neighbors, newspapers, community leaders, employers continuously informed Americans of their obligation to volunteer their labor, their time, and their political support to the war effort. Conformity was considered essential to national security, and local vigilantes were certainly willing to use force if necessary to silence those who offered any criticism or misgiving about the war. Targets were mostly on the political left, including populists, radical socialist anarchists, trade unionists, and of course, German Americans. And in this atmosphere in which challenging not just the war, but the status quo became tantamount to treason, we can see that for social justice movements that were trying to do exactly that, the repercussions could indeed be very severe. And here are a few examples. Military intelligence officials put civil rights groups under surveillance almost immediately. And this had little to do with whether or not they were outspoken against the war or in favor. Just the fact that they were advocating to change race relations and the relationships between blacks and whites in American society was enough to threaten the status quo. The Postmaster General banned their publications from the mails, justifying their actions with claims that German spies certainly must be behind any effort to stir up racial trouble in the United States. The war had cut off the cheap flow of immigrant labor from Europe, creating new economic opportunities for African Americans, and many took advantage of this to begin what we know as the Great Migration, heading north to take jobs in northern factories. And the Great Migration certainly helped black migrants escape legalized segregation, but it did not help them escape racial violence. And in so much that's forgotten about the First World War, one thing that's definitely forgotten is that the war's most deadly racial clash occurred in East St. Louis, Illinois, in July 1917, just a few months after the United States entered the war. And Ida Wells Barnett, an African-American journalist who courageously campaigned vigorously against lynching and racial violence throughout her life, interviewed survivors and sent her testimony to Congress, which eventually had a congressional investigation. And her accounts of the race riot were truly unbelievable. She spoke of black men exiting their homes with their hands in the air only to have mobs stone them to death. Snipers hiding in buildings and picking off black men who walked down the street. Residents fleeing their home and hiding in fields to avoid being boarded up inside while mobs burnt their house down. It was just like war, one survivor recalled. But African Americans were not the only ones to encounter this type of violence. The female suffrage movement encountered violence as well. The Women's Party, the radical arm of the suffrage movement, found a new way to turn Wilson's Democratic rhetoric against him by pioneering a new protest technique, picketing outside the White House. Hard to believe that we did not have people doing this before, but this was the first time. Holding signs that read, "How long must women wait for liberty?" the pickets endured daily harassment and assaults from passersby. And these protests between crowds and these female picketers escalated and came to a head when a delegation from the newly established Russian parliamentary government visited the White House. The women, stood outside with a sign that read in part, "We, the women of America, tell you that America is not a democracy." And the protesters urged the delegation, the Russian delegation, to go in and tell Wilson how to create a democracy. And step one was give women the right to vote. This was something that the Kerensky government in Russia had just done. Alice Paul, actually, who's the leader of the Women's Party, received a note of congratulation from the Russian delegation for her courageous stand. But on that day, the crowd assembled in front had a different response. And the crowd surged forward, ripped the banner from their hands, and the women fled for their safety. They were warned by the police that if they returned, arrests would follow. So we have the civil rights movement, the women's movement, clearly coming under attack in this new environment. And this was the same thing for civil liberties advocates. In the fall of 1917, Roger Baldwin created the National Civil Liberties Bureau. Baldwin assembled a team of 120 lawyers to offer free legal help for men seeking conscientious objector status. But in September 1918, Baldwin resigned as the head of this organization. His offices had just been ransacked by the Justice Department. And even more importantly, Congress had just expanded the ages of the draft. They had now gone from 21 to 30 to 18 to 40. Baldwin was 36, and he had just received his draft notice. Since he had no intention of complying, he knew he was headed to jail. And sure enough, that's what happened. On October 30th, 1918, he was sentenced to 1 year in prison, the maximum penalty for refusing to report for his physical exam. So this is a story of oppression, suppression, and in many ways, I haven't actually told you anything new yet, because this is often where the story stops. But I want the story to keep going, and so this is what I think we also have to add as addendums to each of the anecdotes that I've given you. Because in each instance, the attempts at oppression resulted in a new response from activists that resulted in new organizational strategies, new publicity, and often greater attention to their cause. The racial rioting in East St. Louis, for instance, resulted in July 28, 1917, in an event known as the Silent Parade. And in the Silent Parade, 10,000 African Americans marched down Fifth Avenue in New York City. And as the name of the parade indicates, the marchers were silent. The only sound was a steady drumbeat from a boys' drum corps. Hundreds of children dressed in white holding hands came next, followed by women in white, and finally men dressed in black. And taking their cue from the marchers, the police, and mostly black spectators who watched the parade were also silent. This was the first large-scale civil rights demonstration in American history. There had not been anything like this before organized by the civil rights movement. Now we're accustomed to demonstrations, to parades, to things of this sort, but this was the first time that the civil rights movement had done it. The Chicago Defender proclaimed, "The race is waking up, are together as a unit, and are doing things." Immediately after the march, a delegation headed to Washington, D.C. to present a petition to Wilson, who conveniently claimed to be too busy to see them. It's kind of typical Wilson action here. But they had better luck on Capitol Hill. They go to Congress, where they meet with a congressman, C.L. Dyer, from St. Louis, Missouri. Very interesting. He is very concerned about the riot. He's also concerned that he comes from St. Louis, Missouri, and people would confuse East St. Louis, Illinois with his district. So he's also interested in cleaning up that misapprehension. And in 1918, Dyer introduced the Dyer Bill, which would make lynching a federal crime. And this Dyer Bill became a central piece of the NAACP's civil rights legislative agenda over the next 15 years. The bill never becomes law, but it becomes a way to garner publicity and motivate members. And just as I pointed out that this silent parade, the response to the riot in East St. Louis, is the first mass organized demonstration by the civil rights movement, it's also worth remembering that the NAACP, which to us now seems like the most mainstream, well-established civil rights organization, in 1917 was not even 10 years old. It had just been created and could have easily just disappeared as another one of these organizations that comes and goes, but instead it was destined to become one of the cornerstones of the 20th century civil rights movement. And it was in the First World War that it found many of its causes and much of its leadership and membership. Now, for the Women's Party, this was also a pivotal moment. Upon hearing that arrests for picketing were likely, which is where I stopped the story earlier, the Women's Party embarked on a new strategy of resistance, and this was one where they were clearly looking to Britain and learning from the experience of British suffragists. They would, rather than eschewing arrests, embrace arrests as a way to garner even more publicity for the moment. And Alice Paul later remembered and said, "It was a real turning point. That's when our militancy really began. Now when people come, we tell them, if you come, you will have to be prepared for arrest," right? And this again is an idea of civil disobedience, of using arrests to publicize the injustice of the administration and conversely the justice of your cause. And this is what the women did. Arrests, month-long sentences in filthy, dismal workhouses, solitary confinement, hunger strikes, forced feedings, sometimes even guard beatings. This was the pattern of picketing and arrests throughout the summer and fall of 1917. And although Wilson tried to convince the news media to black out stories of what was going on, arguing that it was detrimental to the war effort, The NWP did in fact enjoy a bonanza of free publicity and articles that detailed exactly what was happening to them. And the suffragists saw the propaganda value of white middle-class women suddenly being subjected to prison conditions normally reserved for working-class prostitutes. And they were not above playing it up. Released prisoners wore their prisoner garb to recount their experiences across the country. They had a special suffrage train, and they literally did a whistle-stop tour, getting off and talking about what had happened to them. And then Alice Paul was arrested. She was arrested in October and sentenced to 7 months. And when the horrific process of force feeding did not stop her hunger strike, she was secretly transferred to a psychiatric ward and denied any outside contact. Guards woke her every hour to prevent her from sleeping, while a doctor visited her several times a day, trying to goad her into making threats against the president, because once she did that, then she could actually be committed to an insane asylum. She's finally located by her officers, and news of her mistreatment comes out as well. Outraged letters pour into the White House mailroom, and we see Woodrow Wilson changing his tactics and ordering the prisoners released. This is a big moment in the suffrage campaign. On January 9, 1918, Wilson comes out and announces his public support for female suffrage. And it was a significant victory for Paul, because the female suffragists picketing outside the White House were able to continually press Wilson to do more. So first he comes out publicly in favor of support, and then when it seems like he's not doing enough to actually convince senators behind the scenes to vote for suffrage, the pickets come back and try to embarrass him again. Paul and her pickets had clearly been a major factor in placing enough political pressure on Wilson to gain his active support for the cause. Okay. And then this last anecdote that I gave about Roger Baldwin. Here we can see as well that the end of the story was not just his offices being ransacked and him being sent to prison. When he faced the judge for his sentencing, he took that opportunity to lay out his objections, not just to the war, but to conscription as an infringement of civil liberties. The NCLB printed his speech and the judge's response in a widely circulated pamphlet, The Individual State, and Baldwin's national reputation skyrocketed. He's finally released from prison in July 1919 and comes out to see war hysteria against war dissenters bleeding into the Red Scare. In 1919, the House of Representatives passed a Peacetime Sedition Act, and this raised the possibility that perhaps wartime sedition was going to become permanent, that this would be a permanent suppression of speech that Americans felt they needed to have in order to defend their nation. And now Baldwin began formulating plans for a permanent organization dedicated to protecting civil liberties. So he begins with conscientious objection, but now it's all American civil liberties. And in the time that he's organizing, this primarily means protecting left liberal causes, the rights of workers, pacifists, radicals, civil rights activists to protest, organize, and demonstrate. And so the end result here in January of 1920, under Baldwin's guidance, is the Constitution of the American Civil Liberties Union, which we, you may or may not know, actually experienced an historic day of fundraising last week. It raised $24 million in one day. So we often think now, where would we be without the American Civil Liberties Union there? So clearly a major institution in terms of protecting civil liberties, and its birth comes out of the First World War. So these are examples of suppression and then responses. And responses that in many ways, because activists were creative in developing new organizational strategies for furthering their cause, in many respects ended up being beneficial, sometimes in the short term, often in the long term. But even this, I feel, is an incomplete explanation of how the war affects social justice movements, because all of these examples that I've given you have been people that really challenged from outside the halls of power. They were people who were standing at the gates of the White House and shaking them and making their demands. But this was not the only way to be effective with social justice issues. And in many respects, it was not even the majority way. Working from within mattered as well. And many people who were dedicated to social justice causes participated in home front mobilization efforts, especially civil rights and suffrage activists. And they hoped, in part, to mitigate the charge of disloyalty. But they also hoped that by developing personal relationships and demonstrating their legitimacy, that they could, in fact, negotiate rather than just outright demand changes in the positions of African Americans and women. So in the eyes of social justice campaigners, wartime patriotism would evoke more than a citizen's responsibility to the state. Citizens also hoped as citizens to make claims on the state as a result of having fulfilled their patriotic duty. So I'm going to go back now to my three movements and talk about it instead of as from without, from within. So the militant tactics of Alice Paul were clearly at odds with the preferred tactics of the more dominant suffrage organization, the National American Women's Suffrage Association. And by 1917, this was a movement that had already undergone a tremendous reorganization. And they had established a formidable presence in Washington, which was dubbed the front door lobbies. Literally, the idea they're going to walk through the front door and begin to talk to congressmen. They recruited socially prominent society women, another way to enhance their image of respectability, including the wives of congressmen. And they would literally make daily rounds to lawmakers, trying to gain an interview with them. And they also organized local and state committees to put pressure on those congressmen through their constituencies. The war requires them to rethink their tactics. Are they going to be a single issue organization as they had been, or would they modify their strategies? And even before the official declaration of war, the NAWS had made plans to volunteer en masse for war work. And as you can imagine, this was a controversial decision. There were people like Alice Paul who completely disagreed with this approach, and there were many suffragists who had been pacifists. And for them also, it was a difficult decision to now think about actually cooperating with the war. But nonetheless, across the country, many self-identified suffragists were participants in every voluntary endeavor connected to the war. They rolled bandages for the Red Cross, opened convalescent hospitals, conducted cooking demonstrations for the Food Administration. They marched in patriotic parades carrying banners that announced their support for the war, but also their support for suffrage. In nearly everything that they did not shed their identity as suffragettes. They wore that identity as they participated in these wartime endeavors. And this show of patriotic endeavor as suffragists, self-identified suffragists, improved their overall images. And they did not just provide workers. They provided leadership within local communities. They had been leaders. They knew how to organize. They knew how to publicize. They knew how to mobilize. And their experience in their own organizations proved invaluable in local committees that were now faced with doing exactly the same thing in terms of home front mobilization. And by securing prominent and coveted posts, suffragists won tacit official endorsement that their cause was legitimate and, this is important, within the boundaries of acceptable political discourse. They were not tarred as radicals. They were within the war effort. They were acceptable. In a sense, they gave suffrage a good name. And when Wilson, for a variety of reasons, decided to publicly endorse female suffrage, he did indeed find it more palatable to present his support as a reward for their good behavior rather than Paul's so-called bad behavior. Right? And Wilson's endorsement matters, but the work that they did on a local level mattered as well. Suffragists became members of the community mobilization. And it did indeed change in many communities attitudes towards the suffrage movement. And a good example of this occurs in Dallas, Texas. In Dallas, Texas, as a result of the suffrage efforts at a local level, in Texas, a law was passed allowing women to vote in state primary elections. And what they saw was that suddenly when they went to register women, there were women from a whole host of backgrounds, from working class to upper class, who now were willing to actually register for the primary. And they felt that this was an example of the kind of goodwill that they had developed through their war work, not so much with men, but even with women who now seemed more willing to even identify themselves with the suffrage cause. And further evidence of the city's embrace of suffrage as a respectable cause came in March in Texas when, during the 1919 general election, there was a referendum on the ballot to allow women in Texas to vote in all elections. Of course, only men were voting on this issue. But throughout Dallas, business leaders had no qualms about offering suffragists free space in department stores to set up their propaganda. Stores had pro-suffrage slogans in their advertising. Editorials in a local newspaper endorsed it. And movie theaters displayed slides that the suffrage organization had prepared. So again, even within the business community, the suffrage movement had earned a lot of goodwill. Dallas overwhelmingly votes in favor of this referendum. The state doesn't. So again, it's not like a perfect success story, which would be nice if it was. But I think the point of the story is that organizing on a local level mattered. And suffragists working within the war movement mattered as well. You had to not just have a suffrage amendment to the Constitution. You had to have women who believed they should vote, that it was right for them to vote. And there were evidence here that, in a sense, you kind of accomplished both goals through your war work, right? Now, in the African-American community, we see a sort of similar dynamic at work. There were many committees formed within African-American communities to organize war bond and food conservation campaigns. And often these wartime committees became incubators for new chapters of the NAACP or locally based civil rights groups. Again, remember what I said earlier. The NAACP is a very new organization. It's still forming chapters. It's still sort of getting the word out that it is the group. And especially in southern communities, this is quite difficult. And the case of Sergeant Edgar Caldwell, I think, provides a very useful case study for how wartime mobilization, these committees that are formed in African-American communities, could become these kind of incubators. They could almost literally take the same community leaders in which they had sort of gotten tacit support from the local white elites to organize in favor of selling war bonds. That's the nucleus here of people who in 1919, 1920, could form a chapter of the NAACP. These people had already learned to work together. They had already learned to cooperate. They had already sort of convinced the white power structure that they were relatively non-threatening. And this is exactly what happens with Caldwell. Caldwell is arrested in 1918 because he's thrown off of a streetcar in Anniston, Alabama, and he pulls out a revolver and shoots the conductor. Right? He's arrested. And as you can imagine, he's sent to jail. He's pretty much on his way to execution. But what happens is that in Anniston, this committee, which had been working for the War Liberty Bond Campaign, this committee basically turns itself into Caldwell's defense committee. And these people come to his defense. They contact the NAACP, and this ends up being a case that goes all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The NAACP has access in Washington to the halls of power. They have some officials that they can contact there. And they argue before the Supreme Court that a state does not have the right to execute a soldier in uniform. What they're trying to do is get Caldwell court-martialed rather than arrested and tried by a civilian jury. Now, in the end, a little bit like what happens in Dallas, it's not a success story. Caldwell loses his case and he is in fact executed. But I think that it's not beside the point for Caldwell, but it's beside the point. It's beside the point in terms of understanding the larger impact of episodes like this on the civil rights movement. Because what the Caldwell case had actually done is it had given the community confidence that it could actually safely mount a defense. And they had gained experience moving a court case through the local, state, and then finally federal, and ultimately Supreme Courts. And as you know, in the 20th century, this would be a major component of what the NAACP focused on as it fought for civil rights moving forward. And they had to start somewhere. And this was the kind of place that they started. And in my mind, this is where we should move away a little bit from only wanting the winning story to see the significant story, because these are organizational experiences that actually matter. Right? Now, for civil liberties advocates, it almost works a little bit in the opposite direction. I started with Baldwin, sort of his offices being ransacked and him going to jail, and then him finally creating the American Civil Liberties Union. But actually, Baldwin was also somebody in the early days of the war who totally believed in working through the channels of power. He himself knew a lot of people in the Wilson administration. Remember, they all thought in 1916 they were progressives together. So in a sense, he didn't think that they were not on the same page. And really, he did not want to openly confront Wilson and especially Secretary of War Newton Baker over the treatment of conscientious objectors in the training camps because he felt it was only going to make things worse. What he preferred instead is to offer his services to conscientious objectors, have them write to him, he would get them a lawyer, and then he would essentially write a letter to the War Department and say, well, it's come to my attention that, in fact, there's all sorts of abuse going on, and basically negotiate an improvement of their treatment. And a lot of times he had to talk conscientious objectors out of taking their cases to the press. These people that often felt publicity was going to help them, he felt it was going to hurt them. And if you look at some of his early correspondence, you'll see phrases like this, right? We don't want to make a move without consulting you. We're entirely at the service of the War Department in rendering any assistance, right? It's sort of the idea that we're in this together, we're going to work through these issues. And part of it was because Baldwin truly believed that Baker, who had been a progressive mayor in Cleveland, did feel strongly that some real policy had to be created about conscientious objectors. He felt that, in fact, he could have a partnership with them. But over time, military intelligence officials completely disagree that the War Department should be working with Baldwin and begin to see it, definitely, as they saw the Civil Rights Movement, as just doing the bidding of German spies. And gradually, over time, with a sort of conspiracy mindset, they convince Baker and his assistants that it's dangerous to continue this sort of collaborative relationship. And so finally, in May of 1918, all communication is cut off, and he's discredited, and we see the legitimacy of Baldwin and his group actually coming into question here. And of course, that's where we get to the point where I began, which was the Justice Department moving swiftly and arresting him there. And it's only after he's arrested that Baldwin becomes more combative. He starts filing lawsuits, he resigns, he refuses to appear for his medical exam, as I've talked about, and then he ultimately goes to jail here. But he had known, and in a sense, he wasn't wrong, because at that point, you know, he gets mad, he resigns, he goes to jail. Ultimately, he'll form the American Civil Liberties Union. But he's basically completely ineffective also in helping conscientious objectors. So he's not wrong to believe that this cooperative relationship is actually strategically likely to be more successful. He had exactly the right idea. Once he becomes combative and begins to turn to the courts, we don't see the condition of individual conscientious objectors improving, and we don't see policy improving. It does not actually become an effective strategy for him here. Okay. Now, finally, I think there's another kind of insider experience that I want to talk about, and this is the ultimate insider experience during a war. It's the people inside the military. So we've talked about activists who are really outside the military, maybe outside of the Hall of Power, some that try to work from within. But even within the military, we'll see that the experiences of men and women have an impact on social justice movements. After the war, we'll see veterans, white and black, and women who mount social justice campaigns aimed at improving their lot. But these campaigns will also have repercussions for all Americans. Nurses, for example. Nurses will campaign to become commissioned officers. This is rank that they believe that they need in order to do their jobs. And they establish strong relationships with civilian leaders in the nursing profession and the suffrage movement, who also see the attainment of rank as another way to assert female equality professionally and politically. And it might not be obvious here why nurses felt that they needed rank in order to protect themselves. They were under the charge of male physicians who, as one nurse argued, assumed the role of, quote, absolute monarchs over them. Male orderlies and patients often refused to listen to nurses. They would have to go get a doctor to actually enforce the most basic of orders. But it was also important for women to have rank to literally physically protect themselves. They were subject to physical harassment from officers and physical attacks as well. Rank, they felt, was necessary for them to do their job, but it was also necessary for them to protect their persons. Of course, as you can imagine, it's difficult while the war is on for women to actually speak out openly about these problems. But really, within a few months of the armistice, we see nurses coming forward and speaking openly about the need to actually achieve a rank that would put them on equal footing with men in the military. They begin making their case to Red Cross investigators. They send petitions and letters to the Surgeon General's office. They write letters to professional nursing publications. They're very outspoken in this cause. And I feel like I'm starting to say this again and again. The end result is not a complete victory, but a partial victory. In 1920, women received something called relative rank, which means they can wear the insignia of officers without the pay and without the full authority. So they, in other words, so what does it do? I guess for people who don't know what relative rank is, it sort of makes them a little more reluctant to challenge a female nurse. What it does is it limits their authority to medical hospitals, and they are still under the command of all male medical officers. This is really so that a nurse could never achieve a higher rank, for instance, than a physician, so that the ordering could actually go the other way around there. But this campaign, like many of the things I'm saying today, would be an opening wedge, and it would be the foundation upon which future generations would build. It's not until 1947 that nurses actually get rank in the US military, right? And we can see a similar sort of working from within with black soldiers as well. For black soldiers, the First World War really puts them in a completely different social climate from that which they came. If you think about it, especially since the majority of black soldiers come from the South for individuals at a time, you know, before the war where the NAACP is not even a major presence yet, it's very difficult to be protesting as an individual or even as small groups. A lot of these men are sharecroppers, they're living in isolated regions. If they participate in the civil rights movement, the danger is tremendous to them personally and to their family. But in the war, what happens is these men are drafted and they're put into segregated units. And segregation in this instance really does work like these other examples I've been giving as an incubator for men to really think about what they could do collectively to redress their situation. And coming out of the war, before we come out of the war, we'll stay in the war, when these men go to France, they experience a different social climate, but they also experience together. So you've got these 25-year-old men, they're together from noon to night, they're living in barracks together, they're marching together, they're either working together or they're fighting together. And when they experience racial discrimination in the military, it's not because it's the first time that they've ever experienced racial discrimination that they become angry and militant. It's because for many of them, this may be the first time they've ever been collectively with a group of similar mindset and similar age with similarly little to lose who can fight back. And so you see a lot of fighting back during the war. The American military is rife with racial rioting and racial violence. You see petitions, letter writing, a lot of coordinated activities that you would not have seen in the same generation of men if they had all remained home. And these are the men that come home. And when they come home, some of them head north. They don't want to go back south. Some of them do head south. Many of them decide to sign up for a civil rights group. They join the NAACP. They join Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association. And in many senses, what I suggest is that it's not just that they have motivation to do it, but they've actually already had a little bit of experience of participating in some kind of pushback against racial discrimination and violence. And that experience is as important as their mindset in terms of encouraging them to participate after the war. And so we certainly see in the post-war period black veterans acting differently. Fighting back, as you might know, becomes kind of the slogan of the new militant phase of the civil rights movement, and that fighting back takes a lot of forms. Sometimes it's physically fighting back against white mobs. We have examples of that in Washington, D.C. and Chicago. Sometimes it's fighting back by simply joining an organization. Sometimes it's fighting back through the courts, right? But there's no doubt that for the modern civil rights movement, both this experience of civilians organizing on the local level and this influx of veterans after the war is going to be major. And you know, we can just even look at numbers, because the numbers of the NAACP, I think I sort of have this here, explode. So you have about 9,000 members in 1918 and over 62,000 in 1919. So in just 1 year, it's almost 50,000 new people come in as dues-paying members. I mean, so imagine all the other people who are actually sympathetic and participating, but not actually paying. So that's a huge increase in just one year. And soldiers also give the NAACP a new cause, and that is the cause to fight for benefits for disabled African-American soldiers. And just as I said that anti-lynching becomes a major component of the NAACP's civil rights campaign, so does fighting for the rights of disabled soldiers. And here's, I think, one of a unique situation where we don't see the NAACP seeing the veterans issue as a kind of issue separate from their main purpose. For the civil rights movement, every victory for a disabled veteran is seen as a celebration and a minor victory in the overall campaign of civil rights. Because what you've forced the government to do is to treat white and black veterans the same. And for the NAACP, that's their point, that in almost every case of a black veteran being denied disability benefits, it's a question of the inequality that's going on rather than what the actual disability a man is facing. And so in this sense, these two groups really work together well. And so the final sort of social justice movement that I want to talk about that connects to veterans is the fight for an equitable distribution of income. That's always a tougher one because you don't really know what to call it. You have civil rights, civil liberties, female suffrage. When you think about sort of the equitable distribution of income, which is sort of itself sort of a mouthful, it doesn't kind of roll off the tongue as a movement, but nonetheless, we know that this is an important movement in progressivism, and it's a movement that's certainly important in the 1920s and the 1930s. And in this movement as well, we see veterans on the vanguard. In the early 1920s, when American veterans come home, they fall in hard times, difficult moment financially for veterans, and they latch on to a cause known as adjusted compensation. And adjusted compensation is really an income distribution argument. They argue that during the war, a lot of profits were made by industrialists, workers were paid high wages, and soldiers missed out on these financial good times. Instead, they were in the military, they got $30 a month, and their argument is that this is unfair. Who's going to make up this difference? How are they going to retroactively be compensated the correct amount? This is the argument behind adjusted compensation, and their answer to that question is the federal government. Only the federal government literally has the power to take profits from war profiteers and redistribute them to the men who fought the war. And that's what they're asking for in the early 1920s. They're asking that these war profits that were sort of illegitimately gained need to be redistributed. They win the argument in 1924, not immediately. They get a bond payment. They get a bond, and the bond will be due in 20 years. So in the best case scenario, it'll be due in 1945. It's a good deal for veterans. Most veterans are going to get between $1,200 and $1,500, which is a significant amount of money at the time. But they're going to have to wait for it. It's going to be more like life insurance or an old age pension for them by 1945 if they wait that long. But of course, they don't wait that long. When the Depression hits, these men want their bonus immediately paid to them, and they organize a mass demonstration on Washington, D.C., the Bonus March, which you've probably heard of, and they march to demand that payment early. The Bonus March is 6 weeks long. It draws a lot of publicity. These protesters, again, don't win. They're violently evicted from the city. But this becomes a key moment when the idea that there's something wrong about the way wealth is distributed in America becomes crystallized for the majority of the country. One of the reasons the Bonus March is always talked about in American history is not because so many people care about the injustice meted out to veterans. What they care about is that there's something wrong with the way capitalism works in the United States. And they gain a lot of attention and a lot of sympathy because veterans have the legitimacy to make that frustration public. And this idea that the government should be doing something to redistribute income to help people legitimately in crisis, this is a message that many supporters of the Bonus March really emphasize. And as we know, in the New Deal, we're going to see governmental policy sort of aimed in that direction, even though ironically, FDR is not a supporter of the Bonus March. And actually vetoes the legislation to pay it early in 1936, and that veto is overridden, and veterans get paid early as well. There is a scholar of that episode who always said that sort of, look, gosh, see, FDR wasn't as good a guy as we thought, but he says it's different. He believes that this just shows what a master politician FDR was, because he vetoes it, so he gets credit for vetoing it, but he knows Congress is going to override the veto, so then when the money goes out and the economy actually improves, he gets credit, he can take the credit for actually making the economy improve in terms of people's income going back. So it depends what you actually want to think he's doing, right? But the real importance of the Bonus March is going to be what happens during World War II, because in World War II, when America once again has to bring veterans home, and this time it's going to be not just 4 million veterans, but 12 million veterans, nobody wants a second Bonus March. This one could be much more dangerous and much more violent. And so the end result is the GI Bill of Rights. And the GI Bill of Rights is a piece of legislation that is pushed through by the American Legion and is a comprehensive benefits package for veterans, which gives them unemployment insurance, rights to education, mortgages, health care. I mean, things that no other American, no other non-veteran is going to have access to in sort of the same range. And it really makes serving in the military during World War II a way to enter the middle class for this generation of men. And this GI Bill would not have existed without veteran activism and this long argument that they had developed that it was morally wrong to financially disadvantage veterans for the rest of their lives because they served the nation during time of war. And so this social justice argument about the importance of equity in how you fight a war in terms of the financial burden that you put on people, this is really at the heart of a piece of legislation which I do not think it's an exaggeration to say is the largest and most successful piece of social welfare legislation that the United States has ever had. Even today, we have national health insurance in the United States if you are a veteran. Right? This has had a really long impact on the United States, right? Okay, so this has been a broad brush. I've thrown a lot of stuff out there, but basically, what my point here is that the war ushers in important changes in the United States within social justice movements. It's not a story of winners consistently, and in that sense, we shouldn't look at the short-term losses, or even some of the times the long-term losses, as unimportant. The female suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, the civil liberties movement, and the fight for an equitable distribution of wealth were social justice movements that all experienced major turning points to the First World War. And in many ways, we could say that what they shared was an animating ideal of deeds, not words. Great. Thank you very much.